Times Square is one of the busiest places in the world. About up to 500,000 people pass through Times Square daily. Because the majority are tourists, it's believed that by owning advertisements in Times Square, you not only signal to America, but to the world that you're a cool brand. For Samsung, getting to cool became a priority as the brand started adopting an unsavory nickname, Samsuck. So in 1995, Samsung invested on a prominent outdoor advertising space known as a Spectacular on the east side of One Times Square. Though it was unmissable, you might need to crane your neck a little higher just to see it. Well, unless you're Spider-Man. In 2002, Spider-Man would fight with Green Goblin in one of the most iconic places in the world, and Samsung was excited. It was Stan Lee's most beloved character. But more importantly, it was touted to have an impressive marketing budget behind it. Millions were expected to catch the film, and Samsung's advertisements will be prominently displayed.
The full trailer is out!
A Samsung employee shouted. For the past few months, a few teasers were dropped, but none revealed the Times Square battle. It's expected that the full-length trailer would include it. Everyone in Samsung was excited to view it. Most of all, Eric Kim. Eric was born in Korea, but moved to California when he was 12. Samsung had hired him in 1999 as the executive vice president for marketing in Samsung, but quickly promoted to their global chief marketing officer. Well, play it. 1.5 minutes in, a bystander on the screen yelled,
"It's Spider-Man!"
And out came the web-slinging hero as he moved through New York's concrete jungle. With a death-defying dive, he had caught a child and squeezed past the iconic 2 Times Square building to safety.
"Is it just me? But where's our logo?"
Eric might have asked. The employees were equally puzzled.
"Play it back."
Again, same scene, with no Samsung logo.
"Can someone help me confirm if we still have our Times Square logo there?"
Eric was getting worried. He had instructed the team to continue paying for the billboard space, and it was notoriously expensive. If his team made a mistake now, it would be a crucial opportunity wasted. An employee pulled out the email. They did buy the billboard.
"Freeze that frame for me. And pull out the actual Samsung billboard photo for us,"
Eric instructed. With a side-by-side comparison, it became clear. Everything was similar except the Samsung logo, which had been digitally replaced by USA Today. It became clear to Eric that Sony, who owned the Spider-Man movie, had erased them deliberately. The war on Sony had begun. From 1UP Media, this is Empires, episode 4 of a 5-part series, A Cosmic War. In 2002, when Sony's Spider-Man trailer was out, they scrubbed off the Samsung logo. It was the moment that Sony started viewing Samsung as a real threat, and with good reason. By now, Samsung had been around for over 60 years and seemed to have gotten its act. Samsung Electronics, which was founded in 1968 as a joint partnership with Sanyo, had begun making its mark in the technology world. In 1970, they released their first black and white TV, and by 1978, they had sold around 2 million black and white TVs. It still paled in comparison to anything Sony had, having won an actual Emmy for their advancement in TV technology. But increasingly, Samsung could not be ignored as they entered the semiconductor space and virtually caught up with both the Japanese and the West. Semiconductors formed the bedrock for most technology, which meant that, as far as the building blocks were concerned, Samsung seemed to have it settled. The change was driven top-down by their leader, Chairman Lee Kun-hee, who took over his late father, Lee B.C., the founder of Samsung. Through Kun-hee's aggressive speeches, known as the Frankfurt Declaration, he fired up the company to think in unison and to pivot from producing high-quantity to high-quality goods. This was making Samsung a really dangerous company, but even then, few had thought they could go up against the big boys. Admittedly, even their own Samsung men had cautioned against it, but nonetheless, they decided to enter America through a number of products such as microwaves, televisions, batteries, and cheap semiconductor parts. But by the end of the 90s, Samsung was confident in entering the handphone segment and intended to flood the market with their cheaper alternatives. The only problem? Mobile carriers used to be the gatekeepers of handphone sales, and Samsung had only been acquainted with Sprint. It's 1999, Kansas City, and KT, a rising Samsung executive, was in the office of Sprint. Sprint is the third largest mobile carrier in America. The first was AT&T, and the second was Verizon. The meeting today was pivotal in establishing Samsung's reputation before they could dance with the big boys. All eyes were on KT to convince the Sprint team, and English was not his first language. KT held up a Samsung phone like a magician and allowed the Sprint executives to observe it closely. He then launched into a frenzy right in front of them, attacking it, pulling at it, trying to squeeze and twist the flip cover in every direction before throwing it on the floor.
"Okay, that's the first,"
a Sprint executive might have quipped. KT, who was noticeably exasperated from destroying his phone, then stomped on it before picking it back up.
"Hello? It's KT here. I was just calling to test my phone."
To the amazement of the Sprint team, the Samsung phone was functioning fine, and KT knew that he had their attention. To send home the point, he pointed to a Sprint engineer within the room.
"Can I borrow your phone for a second?" "Okay, just don't..."
KT had flipped it open and broke the engineer's phone.
"Are you kidding me? My phone is broken. Can I see a Motorola phone?"
KT interrupted. A Sprint executive gestured to bring one over, but before handing it, stared KT in the eyes and said,
"You're not gonna break this one, are you?"
KT proceeded to bring the phone to his face, then shouted,
"Motorola, get out of here!"
before handing the phone back. The room fell silent. It was an unusual pitch that directly attacked Motorola, one of the biggest phone producers. It also showed that Samsung was hungry to beat everyone else, which resonated with Sprint's motto at the time, Sprint Ahead. That crazy meeting would begin Samsung's first foray into the American mobile space. By the year's end, Samsung was capturing the attention of other mobile carriers when it released the SCH-3500, a clamshell model that directly competed with Motorola's bestseller, the Star TAC. The SCH-3500 became Sprint's flagship product that sold for more than 6 million units and stayed in stores for 2 years, twice the average duration. Samsung's strategy was simple: make an impression with an explosive meeting, then follow up with Samsung's value proposition, value for money. To further sweeten the deal, Samsung will also fly other mobile carrier executives into South Korea and give them a grand tour, opening aged whiskey and hiring singers to entertain them. The stories on the celebrations are ludicrous, including gifting a sword to cut a cake, hiring police escorts to clear the streets, and leaving a gift bag of cash by their hotel concierge. Samsung would repeat their theatrics with every carrier, and when Cigular, a new carrier that was acquired by AT&T, came into the picture,
Samsung donated $500,000 to their Hurricane Katrina relief fund.
For context, the average donation size was 10 times less than Samsung's. Theatrics or otherwise, it worked. And by the early 2000s, Samsung was distributed to almost every mobile retailer. However, the bending over backwards became so extreme that Samsung started having multiple customized contracts for each carrier. Eventually, Samsung started to lose its consistency as a company, which was how Eric Kim came into the picture, the man who would unite Samsung's communications and begin the war on Sony. Eric was an outsider, not just in terms of his American upbringing, but in terms of his experience. Traditionally,
the Samsung man had promoted from within,
meaning that Samsung was their first and only company that they worked in. But Eric came with a mishmash of experiences that might be the much-needed diversity within Samsung. He graduated as an engineer, then rotated around different technology companies, most notably in Silicon Graphics Inc., a company that advanced the world of computer graphics. When he entered, he was tasked with unifying the Samsung brand under one umbrella. A monstrous task given that Samsung has 55 advertising agencies, each under separate contracts. To maintain a global, cohesive message, he would first need to unite all these divisions together under one banner. The Samsung line managers were gathered in an office room in South Korea. They were not excited. Rumor has it that the kimchi-eating American will be meeting them.
Hi, everyone.
Eric entered the room.
I'll cut to the chase. This meeting is to help us understand how the marketing budgets are allocated.
Yes, Eric.
The line manager replied.
In Samsung, we view marketing as a part of promotion.
Eric was expecting this. He came prepared.
Yeah, but why?
What do you mean, why?
I mean, why is marketing part of sales?
The Samsung line managers were frustrated. Some probably laughed in their heads that the silver spoon Eric was elevating marketing into anything but sales. To them, any money they earned was hard won and should either be used on R&D to drive a better product or to drive a price war against their competitors. Eric, who in their knowledge enjoyed fine dining, was treating their budget like his lifestyle.
Look, I know you guys don't like me,
Eric explained.
And you'll say that it's not the Samsung way. But setting your marketing budget as a percentage of current sales seems a little short-sighted, don't you think?
The team didn't think so.
If we set it to potential sales, then you'll use your marketing to really get actual future sales.
Again, the team didn't think so.
This is going to be harder than I thought.
During the time that he consolidated marketing budgets, it was well known that he faced a lot of resistance from the factory floor all the way to the C-suites of Samsung. It took countless meetings and a speech from the then CEO of Samsung who hired him before the heads relented. By the next fiscal year, he managed to centralize the marketing budget worth $1 billion and another $400 million for advertising. Now what's left to do is to find an overarching identity, which surprisingly came easy to him. Through conversations with a friend, they knew that Samsung's unified campaign must capture inclusion, optimism, and be associated with technology. The buzzword at the time was digital, and his friend added an L at the back to create Digit All, an all-inclusive campaign where everyone was invited. By the early 2000s, Samsung started to seem more cohesive and, best of all, inclusive. But it was hardly cool, so Eric began finding ways to feature Samsung within movies. Through talks with Sony, He had somehow convinced them to include Samsung within the final Spider-Man release, even though Sony had initially scrubbed it. His success was followed by a deal to include Samsung's phone in The Matrix Reloaded. While Samsung was progressing, it seemed that Sony was stumbling, partly because of the Japanese recession and their CEO's hard pivot into content. Sony had weakened considerably. Even its hold on the consumer electronics market was waning. With its music division under fire by Apple, Samsung thought it was time for them to disrupt one of their biggest segments, televisions.
Who would you like to call?
What are you doing Wednesday night? Cool.
The Samsung digital wireless phone featuring voice-activated dialing. You say the name, and Samsung dials the number, letting every name ring.
It's 2006, and Samsung was preparing to take the television crown from Sony. The time seemed ripe, as Sony had not just fumbled with consumer electronics, but its display divisions were tumbling. Originally one of the largest display manufacturers, Sony layoffs had made LCD production unstable. In an act of desperation, Sony CEO agreed to a joint venture with Samsung named SLCD, which also allowed Samsung to build Sony-grade screens. With Eric's global branding campaign in full swing, the time is nigh for the Sony killer TV project. And Choi Gi-sung, or GS, took up the mantle. GS was a rare commodity in Samsung. He was born poor, smart, but loyal, which landed him in Samsung in 1977. In the past 27 years, GS served not just Samsung, but through his loyalty, served the Lee family personally, and was given the privilege to head the Future Strategy Office, also known as The Tower, Samsung's highest ruling office. This also meant that GS had a unique understanding of what the poor and rich liked, which was pivotal in 2004 as the chief design officer tasked to destroy Sony. With Samsung's blessing and war chest, he selected 11 engineers and designers, had them sign confidentiality documents before instructing them to meet in the Value Innovation Program Center, or VIP Center. It was something like a five-star hotel open 24/7, complete with a gym and pool tables for entertainment. The younger team members might have been excited, but their elders knew what the VIP Center really was. A paradise in hell.
Team,
GS took to the stage.
All of you are selected for a reason, to build the next best TV. To ensure that happens, we've given you the best facilities that Samsung could offer. But make no mistake, you shouldn't leave unless it is to work for the TV. Everything will be provided, so I expect the best results.
It is rumored that the team was then made to swear never to come out of the studio until the project was completed.
Under GS's guidance, they took inspiration from furniture,
a pivotal decision at the time, because TV technology had caught up, which meant that the average television could satisfy most consumers. The defining factor was how the TV looked in your house, an area of competition that furniture manufacturers were well familiar with. GS and his designers believed that to win, they would need something beautiful. A tall feat for the company that traditionally made bulky TVs packed with hardware features. Initially, the project didn't seem to go anywhere. Both engineers and designers would argue on features versus simplicity. But the final result was a small 26-inch TV that looked wide at the top but tapered at the bottom to a small stand. To GS, it looked like a wine glass, so he named it the Bordeaux TV. Uncertain of its success, the team released it to the public in April 2006, priced at $1,300. The public instantly took to its appeal. The soft edges, smart position of its speakers, and vibrant screen had consumers hooked. Within 6 months, it exceeded 1 million in sales, and in that same year, Samsung became the number one manufacturer of LCD TVs
beating Sony for the first time. It would continue to maintain its position undefeated, as of now, for 16 years straight. The era of Sony TV is finally over.
Samsung Electronics has broken another sales barrier boosted by record profits last quarter.
Samsung Electronics has posted another record high profit, and now it has become the first.
It's 2005, 6 years before Apple decides to sue Samsung for infringement, and a Samsung president was in Palo Alto, in the home of Steve Jobs. Jobs had visited Samsung when he was a young man, but today, at 50 years old, he met Samsung again, hoping that they could solve his problems.
As you know, our iPod is a huge success,
Jobs addressed the Samsung president.
When we released it in 2001, it made a dent, and today, it's around 70% share.
The Samsung president knew Jobs was right. The iPod had knocked Sony's consumer music electronics division off the throne.
But now, as music becomes something that consumers can't leave without, we need our iPods to last longer and survive harder knocks. And a huge vulnerable spot is our hard disk. I hear you, Steve.
The Samsung president had placed a NAND flash memory on the table, which was lighter in weight and more efficient than a traditional hard disk.
We think we've got what you need.
Jobs would continue to talk with Samsung's president of semiconductor and memory before inking a deal for Samsung to become the sole supplier of the flash memory in the iPods. This contract would eventually extend to microchips in the first iPhone and up to 70% of iPhone displays, depending on the model. While Apple might be happy with the partnership at first, they would eventually realize that Samsung was following its old playbook of tricks. Build, supply, learn, compete. A potent strategy deployed to defeat Sony in televisions, and one that Apple would fail to see. In the winter of 2011, Samsung would release the S2 and begin the war on Apple. From 1UP Media, this is Empires, episode 4 of a 5-part series, A Cosmic War. Next, in Empires, we'll continue learning the remaining wars that Samsung waged between Apple and Google that birthed the Galaxy series. Follow us so you won't miss out on episode 5 of our 5-part series, A Cosmic War, Part 2. Empires is a 1UP Media original, produced and edited by Guang Jin, audio experience by Ethan Sam, and narrated by Peter Ng. A quick word on our reenactments and dramatizations. While we can't know exactly what they say, think, or feel at the moment, it is all based on research. Thank you for listening.